This HedgeGhoul series of podcasts is brought to you by History Ireland magazine and the Wardwell Group. For more information or to subscribe, visit historyireland.com.
Welcome to this evening's One Dublin, One Book event, which is the emigration story, Irish America in the 1950s. We're delighted to be here in the Epic Museum, and I'd like to say a huge thank you to Julianne and to Roisin for helping us to organise this evening's event. It's the perfect location for an evening of discussion about the Irish American experience. My name is Clodagh Kingston. I'm the director of Dublin UNESCO City of Literature. We run Dublin City Council's annual One Dublin, One Book programme, which encourages the people of Dublin to read and share a chosen book connected with the city each April. So this year's book is Christine Falls by John Banville. If you haven't had a chance to read it, please do. It's a great read, and you can borrow it from your local library in print, ebook, or e-audiobook, or you can buy it from a bookshop, whichever you prefer. So when I first read Christine Falls, I thought that the story that unfolds in Boston was really, really fascinating. So we see the success of the Crawfords, the power that they had within the Catholic Church network, the ambition of Andy Stafford, and the Boston women's stories and how they differed from the experience of the women in Dublin in the story. And of course, the insight into Quirk's complicated past. So I'm delighted to hand over to Tommy Graham from History Ireland to introduce this evening's panel.
Thank you very much. Okay, now, just to explain some of the ground rules here. This is not about the book. This is kind of speaking around the book, right? And just maybe an indication of how many people have read the book at this stage? Okay, so I'll be very much on alert for any spoilers, guys. So just take... You'll be ejected from the place immediately, right? Now, so our topic here tonight is Irish America in the 1950s. Now, most of the action of Christine Falls takes place in the gloomy streets of 1950s Dublin, the very gloomy streets. Far more sex in it, by the way, than I had imagined. And I'm now in the third book, by the way. But it intersects with a parallel storyline set in Boston. So what does this tell us about the post-war Irish American experience? What were Irish American perceptions of the old country and vice versa? So to discuss these and related questions, I'm joined by Dan Mulhall, former Irish ambassador to Washington, Bernadette Whelan on my left here, University of Limerick, and Michael Kennedy of the Royal Irish Academy's documents on Irish foreign policy. And by the way, the last time we had this panel together was at the Electric Picnic. So we're putting the band back together here for this evening. And you know, One Dublin, One Book is an annual Dublin City Council festival led by Dublin City Libraries and Dublin UNESCO City of Literature and supported by the Department of Culture, Communications and Sport. And by the way, just to say, we won't just have Q&A at the end. Once the discussion gets going here, it's open to at any time to the floor to put a question or to make a point. Now, just to get us going, Bernadette, maybe I'll go to you first. I just want to... a recap on the patterns of Irish emigration to the United States. I'm assuming that the high point was the post-famine period, second half of the 19th century, when the Irish in America moved from being, you know, Scots-Irish, Presbyterian, whatever, Protestant, to being Catholic Irish. And that's our perception of Irish America, is Catholic Irish America. And that's the Irish America portrayed in the book. Now, obviously, emigration would have come to an end with the First World War. So my initial question is, why didn't that level of emigration from Ireland continue after the First World War, you know, into the Irish independence period?
Thanks, Tommy. I think the first point to note is that the high point of Irish emigration is 1890, when there were more people who were born in Ireland who were living abroad, and a large majority of them are living in the United States. And by about 1910, there's about 5 million Irish of first generation, second, and indeed even some third generation in the United States. So, and then there are those who might have been there from pre-famine. And so some of those numbers actually then can head from that 5 million up to 15, 20 million. So it's quite a substantial number. And there's obviously, you can see the comparison with Ireland. There are more in the United States than indeed there are in Ireland. Now, in terms then of the decrease that Tommy mentioned, obviously there's the World War I comes into play, number one. And then number two, there's a movement after the First World War in the United States and what's called a return to normalcy. There was another American president who kind of mangled his words a little bit. So instead of return to normality, it was return to normalcy. And the a part of that was to, again, confine America to American-born or as close as possible.
It sounds familiar.
Indeed. And so 1924, the National Origins Act is introduced. And under that act, they introduce quotas. So you have quotas for the first time. And indeed, even though it's 1924, there's actually an informal recognition then of the partition of Ireland, because there's a separate quota for the Free State, as it was then, and for Northern Ireland stroke Britain. And in the Irish quota, which was about 17,000, that is in place right throughout the period. But I've argued elsewhere, it's actually less that quota, because that quota is never actually met in terms of the number of visas they give out. So the Irish don't apply in the same numbers, because what's already happened by then is the immigration continues. But where is it going to? It's going to the UK. It's going to Britain. So those patterns are now more reinforced there. And indeed, some are going off to parts of the Commonwealth, Australia, places like that. And what's more important is the Wall Street crash. So when you look at some of the statistics, you see that by 1930, the numbers of Irish who were given quotas are actually just, it's just 300. So if you think of, you know, the 1.5 million that leave after the famine compared to that 300, you can say that the end of mass Irish mass migration to the United States is actually 1930 and not before that. Now, that doesn't mean that the Irish don't continue to emigrate to go out and come back to the United States, because you also had this thing called non-quota visas. So that if you had family, siblings in particular in the United States who had an address and that, who could provide you with evidence of income that you could present to an American consular officer, generally in Cove or indeed in Dublin where they interviewed people, and you were of good health, obviously, you would actually get a visa. And so in a way that the Irish, because they'd been there for so long, were able to bypass that as well. But in terms of the new arrivals, as I say, 1930 is the collapse, Tommy.
Bernard, I have a recollection that the Irish in America, of all European immigrant groups, had the lowest rate of return. Is that true to the home country?
Yeah, that's another interesting stat about the Irish, I think. You had in 1890... the Irish had just about 2.1% of a return rate, right? By 1920, it has collapsed. It's gone up a little bit to about 10%. But compare that to Irish, to Italian Americans, which is about 40%. So the Irish are really slow to return. Now, what you have in there in those stats, you then have those who come back for long periods permanently, those who come back for short periods, for holidays. And a holiday could be 3-9 months because of the length of time it took, you know, when you could get the boat. And so you weren't going to come back for 2 weeks or whatever, you know. So the return migration figures for the Irish are actually quite distinctive. We can come back to it again later if you...
Okay, I think what you're painting there is that by the 1950s, the Irish in America are effectively on a different planet. If you know what I mean, that there's a separation in time and in space. They're not being replenished by new arrivals from the home country. So in other words, like the perceptions then, there's two separate perceptions of themselves and also of each other. Now, Michael, just bring in the diplomatic state. By the 1920s, Ireland is an independent state. And by the 1950s, we are a republic. What's the diplomatic situation then?
Well, the diplomatic situation is probably seen by the fact that the first place that Ireland opens up a diplomatic representation is Washington, D.C. in 1924. Professor Timothy Smithy is there. By the end of the Second World War, Ireland has a problem in the United States. It's not in good stead. We tend to think of Irish-American relations as always being good, being in a positive framework, but Irish neutrality had gone down badly in the States. And in the post-war world, particularly post-1948-49, Ireland fumbled its NATO application. Sean McBride was minister. And rather than, you know, we think, oh, Ireland didn't want to join NATO, there's a whole sort of argument out there that it was something to do with not wanting to be in military alliances. Well, we did want to be in NATO, but we thought that America would put pressure on Britain to end partition, and we could use our NATO membership. We'll join NATO if Britain ends partition. America will definitely support that. And America said, no, not interested. The special relationship is much more important. So by the early 1950s, Ireland is diplomatically rather out of fashion in the Anglophile State Department, and we have a problem. We have to make up a bit of space. And I think the important point there is the origins of the Shamrock Ceremony that we all are familiar with, the yearly Shamrock Ceremony. Ambassador John Hearn, our first ambassador in the US, 1950, he arrives in DC, and he comes up with an idea that he'll send a small, it was a wooden box then, of Shamrock to Harry Truman. Now, Truman was on holidays at the time, wasn't there to receive it, but it begins the tradition. And so diplomatically in the 1950s, Ireland has to build up its position and try and overcome Anglophile influence, both in the White House and in the State Department, to at least get its ear heard, you know, get its voice heard. And we can look at the political side of this, but remember, Aer Lingus is buying Boeing jets by the late 50s. CIE are buying their mainline diesel locomotives from General Motors in Illinois. There's a wider angle to Irish-American relations than just the Shamrock Ceremony and the yearly pizzazz around that. So it's more complicated than the guys who emigrated in the 20s up to the 30s realize. It's becoming a business issue. Irish-American relations are coming out of the kind of the shamrockery and into, it's the Industrial Development Authority are interested in the US. It's a matter of economic development. So it's moving beyond the kind of environment generally that we see in Christine Falls into something that would be more boardroom issues and big issues in terms of imports and exports. And that's what it goes on to be in the 1960s, the Kennedys and the Kennedy administration notwithstanding.
Now, by the way, Dan, did you ever get any hint of this earlier cool relationship when you were in Washington?
Well, we always knew that the State Department was less attracted to the Irish connection than the White House sometimes, and Congress, of course. You always had strong Irish-American voices that tried to push Congress in the direction of being more sympathetic to Ireland. I remember once hearing Jimmy Carter explain that when he decided to issue the first ever statement by an American president about Northern Ireland, and this statement was a very innocuous, very bland statement, he had to go through hoops with the State Department that resisted this hand in glove, because they just thought it was, why would you do this? Why would you say anything about Northern Ireland and risk discommoding the UK and risk damaging a relationship that was actually valuable to the United States? So there was always that sense that we were likely to have get a better hearing in Congress and even in the White House than we were in the State Department. And I even have to say came across that myself in talking to people in the State Department, who I felt were less enthusiastic than, say, you got certainly from Congress, but also from the White House itself.
But I get the impression that's a totally different world to the Irish American community that we're looking at here. That, you know, we don't only have the embassy in DC; there are consulates in New York, Boston, Chicago, San Francisco.
But you know,
we're looking at the diaspora to a greater extent. Maybe,
you know, Michael, one of the things I read this long report that John Hearn wrote in the early 50s, and it's a kind of a survey of Irish America. And you can tell from this that John Hearn doesn't have much time for Irish America. He says, well, the AOH are not much good, really, and the Friendly Sons of St. Patrick, you know. And I think, and he also says that we should have a cultural foreign policy approach in the United States. Now, I'm not sure how that would have worked in the 1950s, what kind of culture we would have been willing to endorse as representing Ireland. Would we have been happy to do a Bloomsday, for example, in the 1950s? I somehow doubt it. But nonetheless, I think he was hitting on an important point. And I, reading John Hearn's reports, and I'm from Waterford, as he was. So, in fact, before I went to the United States, I went to a seminar in Waterford to celebrate the fact that he was involved in writing the Constitution of 1937. He was the chief draftsman of the Constitution because he was the legal advisor in the Department of Foreign Affairs, and De Valera brought him onto his team. And that weekend, about a month before I left for the United States, they unveiled a bust of John Hearn, which is, can be seen in what's called Constitution Square now in Waterford. And the mayor at that time announced that he had commissioned a second bust that I was going to take with me to the United States. So I had to ring the Department of Foreign Affairs and say, would it be okay if I put a very heavy piece of a bust of John Hearn into my suitcases and my other effects that were being transferred to the United States? And that bust was actually sitting in the garden at the embassy during the entire time that I was in the United States as ambassador. But the point I want to make is that I felt sorry for the diplomats at that time because they were so under pressure on the anti-partition issue. I mean, that seemed to be, every time he reports, it seems to be, I talked to somebody about partition. And he says in that report, he says that there isn't much support in the United States for the anti-partition campaign. There's not much political interest in the subject. And that was the reality. But they were forced to continually bang that drum. And you could tell that they were banging that drum to deaf ears because nobody, even in Irish America, wanted to hear about that issue. Irish America were very active when it came to independence in the 1910s and 20s. And they were very effective again in the 1970s when it came to pushing back and to promoting peace in Northern Ireland, and in the 90s with Bill Clinton. And then even in the last number of years on Brexit, they were very effective in helping to avoid the imposition of a border on the island of Ireland. But on the anti-partition issue, that left most Irish Americans, I think, quite cold. It just didn't sort of resonate with them in the way that the independence struggle did or the need to bring peace in Northern Ireland did later on.
I think they're looking back to the independence struggle in the 50s as well. There's a sentimentality, a sentimentalism for the Ireland they remember creeping in, and the diplomats and many of the consuls are of a younger generation than those who emigrated up to 1930. They find that they're bringing over the image of an Ireland that doesn't resonate, that isn't known by those who emigrated, even if they did return on the odd time and go on holidays. There's a separation between Irish America of the post-war period and the modernising Ireland of the 50s and the Lamass era in the 60s, and they're increasingly out of touch.
Okay, I want to get back to Irish America, right? You know, by the 1950s. Now, it's true that you know the Irish in America were upwardly mobile. You know, late 19th century into the early 20th century. I mean, it's summed up by that marvelous entitled book, "How the Irish Became White." Who wrote that? Who's the Ignatieff? Anyway.
Noel.
Yeah. Anyway, it kind of sums it up pretty well. Bernadette, could you talk to us about that? Just give us a profile. I mean, my understanding is it was mostly urban in the East Coast cities, New York, Boston, and Boston in particular. Just talk to us about that, because that's the milieu that is in this book.
Yeah,
Boston Irish.
Just to link it a little bit to what we've been talking about in terms of the politics. What's very clear in Boston by 1950 is, A, it's at the height of its, just two issues context, A, it's at the height of its population as a city. There's about 801,000, and the population declines after that. The second point to make is that the economy, so the demography of the city begins to decline after that. The economy also declines after the 1950s, right through to the 1970s, largely because the manufacturing industries, you know, particularly textiles, had begun to decline, and also the dockyards had closed where a lot of the Irish had found employment. So the city itself is also changing from being an urbanized, an Irish American, Boston American is changing from being an urbanized cities-based community to being a suburban. So you have the flight from the cities. Now, we're familiar with that more generally, but certainly is very obvious there, because what Boston Irish are by then, and indeed by then they are described as the most Irish city in the United States. The Boston Irish are in a state of transformation, just as the demography is, the economy is, so also is society. Because they are... those kind of working class jobs are beginning to move and be lost and go outside the state. And then also those who are in the middle classes or into the more wealthier classes, like we have Josh Crawford, from those of you who've read the book, you know, who is representative of a kind of an individual Irish-American who's done well out of, in that case, the haulage or transportation business. We also know from, there's the funeral in the book, I don't know if many of you remember, are indeed from the funeral and the Christmas party. There's a reference to politicians turning up, Irish-American politicians, to the Cardinal, Archbishop turning up. And indeed, Irish-American politics had begun to transform by then within the city itself. And I think to come back to Dan's point and Michael's point, those Irish-American politicians, what they have by then and have achieved, they've become mayors. But what's interesting is that there's a very important election in 1949 where a guy called John Hines, who had been a clerk in the mayoralty office and then in turn became acting mayor in the absence of James Curley, who was a member in Congress, and then he's cited for... What is he cited for? His crime was...
Some form of corruption, I think.
There you go. Probably corruption, yeah. And Curleyism becomes synonymous with corruption. And he comes back and he tries to resume being mayor and he's put into jail. So Hines comes in and steps in. But Hines is a transformative character. He's not the old traditional ward boss, which the Irish politicians in Boston had built their power on. And he, in turn, is much more interested in the transformation of the city. Now, it takes you 10 years to come. And any of you who've been to Boston will know how they've filled in so much of... They knocked some of those old dockyards and factories, rebuilt, and things like the Prudential Building, the big lane highways that go through the city. A lot of that happens begins in the 1950s. In turn, that affects then, as I say, the kind of the profile of the Boston Irish there. And there is this more movement out into the suburbs. But they're less interested in, as we've just heard, the higher political issues. For example, in the Banville book, there's no reference really to Ireland or Irish politics. These Irish-American politicians, and this has always been the case, and even when you look at their labour unions, it's the same, where the Irish predominate, and they do also in Boston. They're not interested, really, in getting involved in the Irish cause. They're much more interested in it for their own sake. And in this case, in the book, what we do see is their interest in Ireland is to preserve its traditional conservative Catholic nature. And that's why they see and look to Ireland as a source for, as we know, possible adopted children, voluntary, involuntary, involuntary. So that kind of, the Boston Irish are quite specifically Irish in so many ways, but at the same time, their ethnicity and their links to home are much lessened. And their priorities are at Boston and their priorities are American first, more than anything.
Dan, can I just come to you because, and just following on from Bernadette has said, in terms of Irish America's political success, right? Because JFK was elected to the House of Representatives.
He represented the Senate. He was in the 40s in the House.
Yeah.
He became a senator in 52.
Oh, so senator in 52, right. So how significant was that?
You see, I take the view that the 1950s was the high water mark for Irish America, because you had, first of all, the election of John F. Kennedy to the Senate in 1952. Now, he had been a member of the House, but being a member of the House was more straightforward because you could find areas which were predominantly Irish and where a Kennedy would be able to waltz home as a Democrat candidate. But the Senate was a different story. And remember, JFK's grandfather, who was a legendary mayor of Boston, John F. Fitzgerald, or known as Honey Fitz. And by the way, there's a restaurant just down the street here called Honey Fitz. I presume it's called after the same gentleman. But he tried to get into the Senate 40 years before and failed. Even though he had been a very successful mayor of Boston, he'd been a member of the Massachusetts State Senate, but he didn't get elected. And the difference between then and the 50s was that Kennedy represented a different version of Irishness, a different version of Irish America. In other words, and remember, he was up against Henry Cabot Lodge. Now, Henry Cabot Lodge was about as much of an establishment figure. And by the way, in the book, there are several references to the Boston Brahmins. And the Boston Brahmins were people whose parents or great-great-great-great-great-grandparents had come over, perhaps on the Mayflower. These were the established elements in Boston society. And they resented the Irish. And by the way, in my time in Boston, I heard Irish-Americans say, you know, the Brahmins still dislike the fact that we've taken over the city, but the hell with them, more or less. So there's still that edge there, even to this day. And by the way, I had the privilege once of being invited by Ethel Kennedy to go out to Hyannisport to stay at the Kennedy compound for a weekend. And I remember asking them why they ended up in Hyannisport, because it's a relatively distant place from Boston, out on the Cape. And they said because in the 1920s and 30s, that was the only place closest to Boston where Kennedy's father was able to join a golf club, because as a Catholic, even a very wealthy Catholic, he was not able to join a golf club anywhere closer to Boston than Hyannisport. And that's why they ended up in Hyannisport. So the point I make is that Kennedy, John F. Kennedy, emerged from that milieu, but he transcended that milieu, and he made sure there's a great. I was involved in I have a chapter in the Routledge History of Irish America, which came out last year. And there's one wonderful chapter about Irish-American politics in the 1950s, which makes the point that all the old ward bosses that were friends of his father, Kennedy kept them. He kept them at home. He kept them back. They didn't go out on the campaign trail because he didn't want to project that kind of image of Ireland or Irish America. He wanted, so, and even though he had an Irish mafia, he had Kenny O'Donnell, he had Powers, he had Larry O'Brien, he had a whole bunch of Irish Americans, but they were a younger generation and they were very different from the old ward bosses, the people like Curley, who had become synonymous with a certain type of politics that his grandfather, JFK's grandfather, epitomized. And there's a great story in Douglas Hyde's diary of his visit to America in 1906 and 7. He went there to raise money for the Gaelic League. He stayed 7 months. And when he got to Boston, there was a reception for him at the, there were two stations going into Boston. And the first station, he was met by a delegation, which included Honey Fitz. And he had this photograph taken and the media were there and so forth. Then he went on to the main station and realized that the actual mayor was there. But Honey Fitz had gazumped the mayor by meeting the train before it got to the main station, before the mayor could greet this great Irishman visiting America. And he'd had the publicity out of it and was gone. And the mayor ended up in second place. So that was the kind of politics that these people played. And JFK wanted to play politics in a different way. And he managed to do that, to his credit. And by 1960, he was elected as President of the United States, first Catholic to occupy that office.
Just before I move to Bernadette, just to make the point you were talking about the success of Honey Fitz, he was also a successful bootlegger during Prohibition.
Was that his father?
Joseph P.
That was JFK's father. Honey Fitz was JFK's grandfather. He was Joe Kennedy. Joe Kennedy was the one. He's accused of being a bootlegger. Whether he was or not, it might have been just the dark arts of people who didn't like him. But he obviously was he was a controversial character.
But my point being that going back to the character in the book, the Crawford character in the book, there's a whiff of kind of criminality, you know. So it sounds to me pretty authentic, you know. But Bernard, I want to go on to you. I want to shift the focus here now to Irish perceptions of the United States in this period, right? Again, there's a big distance physically, and it seems to me, compared to the earlier phase of emigration, right? I mean, what was the perception then in the 50s of the United States, of the Irish in the United States?
Well, there's a woman who emigrates to the United States in 1961. There's an oral history project that was done by UCC called Breaking the Silence, and it was largely immigrant women. And this woman was called Brenda. And she said that she wanted to go to the United States still in the 1960s because it had still a sense of fair play for women. And one of the major draws for women, and we haven't talked too much about women, Irish women in particular, specifically, is that one of the distinctive features of Irish immigration, the late 19th century onwards, is that various periods, more women than men emigrated. And they are from that kind of 16 to 35-year-old age. They're single. And because of their... Obviously, there's a whole sense of sadness at departure and leaving home and the American wake and all that kind of stuff. But they still even... You know the character Brenda in the book, the one who comes up in the first...
The book opens, but the wake's gone upstairs where your man's in the looking at the bodies down in the basement, right? But, I'm not going to run away here, by the way.
No, the very first page, she's leaving a job in Dublin as a nurse. And there are an awful lot more who do that, an awful lot of women. Particularly one of the problems that was there was women who were domestic servants. There was what was called the maid problem in Ireland, right throughout the interwar period. And the maid problem was even brought up in the Dáil because they couldn't get any maids. And why was that? It was because the conditions in Irish were so harsh. You had to wear a uniform. You mightn't have the same day off every week. The wages were low. And there was this whole sense of deference. Whereas in the United States, by the 1950s, it's quite the reverse of all those things are in place. Now, obviously, there are examples where that's not the case and there was exploitation and abuse, etc.
But just to make the point, though, that I mean, the 1950s is seen as conservative both in Ireland and in the United States, but from in terms of income, this is the most egalitarian period of US history.
That's my point.
The gap between rich and poor. Yeah. So even somebody getting an unskilled job was making good money.
Yeah. And also you had...
60s, 70s even.
Yeah, but you also had the chance to move to a better paid job. So if you didn't like your job, childminder in Brookline, you could move on to another job. And because they had these networks and circles, as you know, that we use the phrase chain migration, there's a whole network of people, of young women and young men writing back to siblings and friends saying, come out, I can get you a job. So America is still seen as a place to kind of fulfill your American dream. And obviously, there's still the majority, as we've said, as I said at the beginning, are going to the United Kingdom and to Britain. But for those who go to the United States, it still has that kind of whiff of, as our young woman here says, you know, it's a place where you could find yourself. The other big draw of it, I'll just finish on this, Tommy, is it was a place where you could get education. And Irish America by then, and including Boston America, they had identified that education was the way forward. It was the way towards social mobility and better employment, better status, better living conditions and hope for your family. Many of them who do still want to go, and you have even things like the Irish Messenger. I don't know, maybe it's parents who might remember the Irish Messenger coming in. But the Irish Messenger had letters from young men and young women in America saying, come out, you can get night education in a technical school. You can go to college and improve yourself. So those things were attractive still for people who had personal ambition as a motive, you know, for immigration.
Okay, you've painted a picture there of the American dream, you know, for particularly for female immigrants, right? Michael, I want to go to you because, and you mentioned Brenda, right? There's a quote from Brenda, right, which points a totally different picture. And this is typical John Banville, you know, kind of what sort of look of jaundiced view of the world, right? Just give it because it's a brilliant quote.
I'll just find it here now in my notes because you've got it there. When the impression
I have it here. It says Brenda had expected America to be different from home, the people happier, more forward-looking, friendlier, but they were just the same as her own folk, just as angry, as petty-minded, and afflicted.
Yeah, I mean, that really struck me when I read it. The American dream that Bernadette's been describing. And then, it's all just like it was back at home. And it was the America of nightmares I saw in the book. I was surprised, not maybe unexpectedly with the way John Banville writes. It was the America of Norman Rockwell pictures and Edward Hopper, you know, the girl in the cafeteria on her own at night and that kind of thing. I thought it was quite miserable. And America, as it comes out, is a place of nightmares. Everyone's dream seems to be broken in it. nobody really, there's no happy endings, there's no wonderful outcomes, and it's totally different to the maybe the imaginings in Ireland of what you're going out to, and also how those who remain in Ireland imagine how life is going on out there. I'm thinking of the colour pictures we have at home of people from my mum's family who emigrated in the 20s after the Civil War. And these are these sort of wonderful technicolour people living the dream. But they've their own problems. They've their own lives going on. There's the bitchiness that Brenda talks about is there as well. So I think we have to factor that in. The reality is very different. And reality on the ground in 50s America, as Banfield paints it, is not the dream.
Now, we've already referred to Irish-American perceptions of Ireland, kind of a static image, if you like. And Bernadette, you just briefly averred to it. And this is the meat of this book, actually, in many ways, is Ireland as a source of white Irish babies, right? I can't put it less crudely than that, right? I mean, Quirk in the book, of course, is adopted. And maybe before I go to you, Bernadette, just like, there's an ambiguity throughout this whole book, both in either side of the Atlantic, right? Michael, I just ask you, because you were adopted, right? And you have obviously some insights in this. How does Bandel handle that whole question in the book? Does it ring true to you?
It rings true to me, but I've got to say, I had the world's happiest adoption, so I'm not going to go into it here because you're not interested in it, but it's the opposite to what is described here. But nevertheless, there were so many episodes and emotions and themes that resonated with me. The commodification of the infant, I thought, was fascinating. The export of problems. Oh dear, the girl is pregnant. We have to push that off somewhere where it can't be found. My own birth mother had this experience. And then the search for identity. And all the characters in the book are looking for something. They're looking for who they are, what they are. And it's, I think that really does resonate home to any, I'm sure some of you out there are adopted, that who am I? Where did I come from? What am I? And maybe you can create your identity in America, or maybe you can't. Maybe, like as Brenda describes, it's all in there, in with you anyway, genetically. And then the sense of loss. I think there's a great sense of loss throughout the book that no one gives up a baby willingly. When I spoke to my birth mother about this, she said, I didn't give you up for adoption. You were taken from me. And so the way she described nuns, the nuns that she was dealing with, is very much resonant to me of the way Banville describes the two nuns and the priest with the red hair, the unctuous priest that's there. So, but there's also with Quirk as well, the character. And for me particularly, the sense of chase and discovery. I was, from a very early age, wanted to find out where I was from, what was the background. And I think Quirk is doing that all the time. Even the fact that he's dealing with bodies, looking, investigating, that's very much there as well. So, I mean, there were, and also the, I'll finish on this one because I could talk about this for, hours. There's also the sense of confidentiality. You can't say anything. Oh, she's pregnant. Okay, we've got to change that. We've got to move that. We've got to get this out of our social circle, our middle-class Dublin social circle, because God forbid anyone would find out. So I think he does quite a good job in there, but it is a very dismal, depressing read, I thought. And that's kind of the historiography of adoption in Ireland, if you like. But there are those of us out there who've had a wonderful experience and, for whom it was very, very positive. But, I mean, the media don't like that sort of a good news story. Wouldn't be very good. So I thoroughly enjoyed the book from that point of view. And it did. It always, that point. Yeah, it rang home.
Okay, Bernard, I want to bring you in here because in the book you have the Knights of St. Patrick, right? It's obviously a fictional name, at the centre of which this guy Crawford and obviously these Irish-American money bags. And there's this whole, obviously illegal scheme. And that these children aren't even adopted. They can be taken back from the parents, right? Incidentally, this seems to be a trope that crops up. I remember watching a film recently, 1981 film, James Caan called The Thief. And in it, part of the plot line is he can't have a child. So this Irish-American criminal, played by Malachy McCourt, who else, offers him a child, and then uses that to get a grip on him, right? So how accurate, given that it's a fictionalized account, is this whole thing of the Knights of St. Patrick? Did such organizations exist, and how did they operate, if they did exist?
Yeah, I mean, when you look at the Catholic organisational aspect of the whole thing, obviously we're very familiar in Ireland of how it operated. And we know from the commission reports, the detailed commission reports, and we know from the work of the Clan Project how it operated. In the United States, there's similarly the same kind of associational culture built among Irish Catholic, Irish American and Boston Catholics I have just a little thing here from the book itself. Some people are not meant to have children. Some people haven't the right. And who decides? We do. We decided. Women in the tenements of Dublin and Cork, bearing 17, 18 children in as many years. What sort of a life would these youngsters face? Many of them thought that nothing better could happen to those children than to be... than to go to America and be taken to America. Now, that phrase taken, it comes up all the time in even immigration folklore. That's on the wonderful UCD National Folklore Commission project that's online. You look up some of the transcripts there, and this is going back to the 1880s and 1890s, that people come home and take children back with them. Take siblings or friends' children or anything like, you know, any young people. So in a way, your point, Michael, about children are seen in transactional terms and not in terms of child welfare. That's kind of part of a psyche that's there anyway, that America could offer nothing better. But just to come back to the Catholic point, what you do find is that within the American context, that there's great faith placed in the National American Association of Catholic Charities, which was an umbrella organization set up in 1910 by the Vincent de Paul. And it operated throughout the United States. And it was the organization that both the Department of Foreign Affairs in Ireland, that the US authorities and indeed British authorities, that they were technically supposed to be going out around making sure that the families were okay who were going to adopt the children. And all they were interested in was to give children a proper Catholic upbringing. That's all they wanted. But that's not just unusual in the case of Ireland. Just to quickly say, there's a whole history of US adoption where there are scandals, right through from the 20s right through to the 1970s in America. A woman called George Tan in Tennessee set up her own private adoption agency where she took children and sold them, babies. 5,000 of them until 1950. She died just before she was to be prosecuted. There were no proper records at all of who these children were. And the other aspect is a fellow called Dr. Thomas Hicks. And he's another one of these who was in Georgia. And he, again, trafficked 500, 600, 700 kids, if not more, on the basis that nothing better could happen to them than to be adopted by, you know, white parents.
Now, Michael mentioned the kind of secrecy of this, right?
Yeah.
But the U.S. consulate in Dublin issued, you know, visas for 150 children.
Yeah.
So
on the
basis, that's no secret.
That's no secret.
This is like policy.
And it is policy, because what did the Irish authorities and the American authorities do? They say, well, let's go back to McQuaid in Dublin, Archbishop McQuaid. And he set out his 6 or 7 criteria that the children, and the main priority there is that they would go to Catholic homes. It didn't matter what the conditions were like. They would go to Catholic homes.
And the Department of Foreign Affairs is very concerned about this as the 50s progress.
Yes.
That the diplomats realise, we shouldn't be doing this. Yeah. Particularly some of the younger diplomats, and they're all male.
And Noel Brown, to be fair.
Yeah, so that we're providing them with passports, but this is not right. And when some of the more elderly priests from the American adoption networks come to Dublin, are interviewed in Ivy House, after the interview, the guys who interview them on the DFA side said, this man is senile. This is not what we should be doing. Yet there's the feeling. There was one quote in the book that I thought I could add on to what you'd read out there. And it's, we have a duty to make the world a better place through adoption. And that really, really struck me, because the Staffords will become a normal couple if they adopt. And that's there's a whole issue in there of what it means to adopt and what it's doing to their family. And you see how Andy is attacked and belittled and slagged by his workmates for the guy who can't get it up, so he has to adopt a child, and that there's a whole other issue in there as well to deal with.
Just before we go to Dan, I just want to say, if anyone in the audience wants to ask a question or make a point, now's your chance. We're running out of time. You better get in quick here, because these guys will keep talking. Okay, I'll take a question first. I'll come back to you. Yeah.
My name is Mike Walsh. I'm a London Irish. Just want to make a brief point, if I can. I was born and reared in Essex, just outside London. Very, very close friends to people in the North Bronx who are kind of part of our extended family. And it just touches a little bit on what you'll be talking about. We had a lady, they were cousins of a lady who lived with us for many years. My father was a GP in Dublin. The lady who lived with us was a lady called Tess, who was brought up in St. Joseph's Institution in Kilkenny. And, of course, we found out a lot about these institutions in recent years. And it's just a little bit about, because we're still very, very close to these people. And Tess had a fascinating story, which I won't go into now, you know, but it just struck me there when you're talking about the... I mean, obviously, you're talking about more about the orphanages, but it just touched on me a little bit, my own experience. Sorry?
Have you read the book yet?
I've halfway through it. Okay, so don't give away the end.
We won't spoil it for you.
Okay, no, Dan, I just want to go to you because you have a few anecdotes of people you met in the course of your work as ambassador. Who were, you know?
Yes, well, in particular, there was a couple that we knew. We had dinner with them a number of times. They were at the embassy quite frequently, and we'd known them for maybe 3 years or so. And at one stage, he asked if he could come and see me. So he came to the embassy, and he said to me, he said, "My name's not Irish because I was adopted." And I said, "Oh." And he said, "I was born in Ireland." I had no idea. I had known him for a number of years. I had no idea. And he told me that, and I said, "Well," he said, I was one of those children adopted from the mother and baby homes, right? And I said, and he said, "I've never broached this with anybody before, but now that because I know you well, I'm wondering, could I get an Irish passport?" And I said, "Well, of course, you were born in Ireland." He said, "I have no birth certificate." What he had was, I said, "Well, show me what you have." He had a piece of paper issued by, with his name on it and the name of his adopted parents, issued by some organization in Dublin that I never heard of, wasn't any official organization. And he obviously, on that basis, his parents were allowed to take him out of Ireland. Now, he was fortunate because I had heard of his father, so his father was a relatively well-known individual. I won't mention the name because it's confidential. But, you know, he had a very good experience and was brought up in a prosperous family. But this couple, he told me his adopted parents were living in Europe for a number of years, and they passed through Ireland and picked up his baby and brought him back. And all he had was a piece of paper with no official status whatsoever. I don't even know how he got out of Ireland. He didn't even seem to have a passport at that time.
What age was he?
Well, he would be roughly my age. So he was, I'd say, born in... Well, as a baby. So this was clearly an adoption that was quite irregular. Now, the fact that it worked out well is another matter, but it obviously... Not all of these adoptions probably did work out that well. The other example, and I actually got him, I wrote to the department and I got him a passport because I felt that, you know, the state had let him down, and even though he might not have had all of the documentation you might need in normal circumstances, clearly he was a victim of very lax arrangements that applied at that time. And, you know, you can see in the reports in the documents on Irish foreign policy that the diplomats were worried about this, and they were asking questions about it. But I had another example of a prominent American who told me that he'd been adopted, and he had been born in an orphanage. He wasn't born in Ireland; was born in America, but of Irish American parents. And he'd been adopted, or he had been put into a home run by nuns. And on a Sunday, they would take a group of children out on buses and bring them out to outlying towns and basically hand them over to adopt it. Now, again, this person was fortunate that the parents that took him on turned out to be good people, decent people who brought him up well, and he and his sibling, who was also adopted in the same situation, did very well in life and became quite successful people. So the point I make is that this book is capturing something about the haphazard way in which, not just in Ireland, by the way, but in America too, the haphazard way in which these issues were dealt with in the 1950s, before the Adoption Act. And of course, this person that I'm talking about was probably adopted after the Adoption Act of 1952 was passed, which meant that it shouldn't have been happening then, but it obviously still was.
So, I mean, it was the Wild West, excuse the phrase, until 1952 anyway. But you're saying even after that, there were still problems.
Absolutely. Irregularities going on.
It doesn't make any difference, Tommy, the 52 Act. It doesn't make any difference.
Any other questions? Good, but we'll have to wrap up here shortly. Yeah.
I just want to ask, was there any money exchanged hands during these adoptions?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah?
Yeah.
A subscription, a donation.
Yeah.
Sorry, I thought we were going to get a one-word answer from somebody on the panel there.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes.
Just moving aside a bit from matters previously discussed. I am Irish, obviously, and we hear about the Irish-American experience in novels and films. Maybe this is a subject for another day. Mm-hmm. Germans went to emigrated to America. Mm-hmm. Italians emigrated to America. Mm-hmm. So would the panel like to say anything on a comparative basis about different countries emigrating to America?
I could come in on that, Tommy, while you're...
Out of our problems are unique.
Yeah, no, they're not. Yeah. Similar situation to what we've been describing here in Greece after the Second World War and the Greek Civil War. Orphan children sent through a similar process to the United States.
Italian-American children, Italians. I mean, the two countries in Europe that are identified by the US Consul General in Dublin and in London are the Irish and the Italians are send out children most. The French refused to send out children. The Belgians did and the Dutch did. Now, I kind of thought, you know, if it was the basis of religion that maybe the French might have, but and did that account for it, but obviously not. And the Irish and it's the Irish, the Italians are seen in that way. There is a case in, I'll just quickly tell me, one of the other kind of notorious cases, scandals really, that carried on into the 1950s, following from the Georgia Tan and Tom Hicks thing that I talked about earlier, was the case of Hildy McCoy Ellis. And she was a young woman, a baby, born to a Boston American. Her name is Marjorie McCoy, and a nurse. And the child eventually is put up for adoption. Marjorie McCoy makes it very clear she doesn't want the child. The Boston courts, and the Boston courts and the Boston church pursue her and her parents because she's given to a Jewish couple. From 1951 to 1957, and both Boston, Massachusetts Press, New York Press, Florida Press, it's a national scandal that carries on the whole way through. And even though that Marjorie, she did marry, she had her own family, she still doesn't want the child. They could not tolerate the child being brought up by Jews and by people of the Jewish religion at all. And who's prominent in that also, and this is the hypocrisy which comes through in the book, is that one of the prime movers in trying to get to reverse and have that child, because they take her out of state, was Cardinal Cushing. Cardinal Cushing, who's best known for promoting inter-ethnic and ecumenism in Boston in the 1950s and the 1960s, and particularly attends Jewish ceremonies to try and reduce them. But at the same time, he pursues these people through the court. And even though the child is 6, 7, 8, the church in Boston under him still wanted the child to be returned. And it's not as if she'd be given to a Catholic. She would be given to a Catholic family, but it wouldn't even be to her own birth people. So your point about, you know, other ethnic groups are, it seemed to me, there's a lot of comparative work to be done still on that.
Okay, I'm going to have to wrap it up there, guys. Now, we've mainly been looking at this adoption question from the American side, but as part of the One City, One Book program, there will be a lecture in Inchicore Library The title is The Unveiling of Ireland's Shameful Legacy with Caelan Hogan and Phil Mullen. So that's the Inchicore Library, 6 p.m. on Thursday, the 23rd of April. And you'll find all the details in the programme of the One Dublin, One City. So I'm going to wrap it up there. Just like to thank our speakers, Dan Mulhall, Bernadette Whelan, Michael Kennedy, and you, the audience, for turning up, particularly those people who made a contribution from the floor. And a shout out for Gabriel Padrone on sound. So thank you very much, and I hope you attend some other of our events. Thank you.